Welcome and thank you for tuning in to our podcast for AHA's ongoing series, Hospitals Against Violence, where we focus on highlighting important issues in community and workplace violence, the impact on the practice setting and the workforce, and efforts to mitigate this violence. My name is Veronica Riley, and I am the AHA Workforce Center Director. In this podcast, we focus on the important issues around workplace violence for those who work outside of the hospital setting, specifically those providing home health care. Joining me today is Joyce Bowman, Vice President, Clinical Operations at Hospice of the Valley in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome, Joyce, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Could you please give us a short description of Hospice of the Valley, its clients, and its workforce?
Hospice of the Valley is a nonprofit hospice that provides hospice and palliative care to patients and families in central Arizona. We're currently celebrating our 40th anniversary, and which puts us among the nation's oldest and largest hospices. Last year, we served more than 17,000 patients and families. About 13,000 of those were in the hospice program, and the rest were cared for by our palliative care program. Hospice of the Valley employs about 1,400 people and is supported by 2,200 volunteers.
What would you say are the three biggest issues around workplace violence that impact those working in home settings?
So I think that the three major areas that we deal with are, first of all, is environmental. The fact that we are going into people's homes puts us in a different situation than someone that's caring for someone in an inpatient setting. Some of the issues that we deal with on a pretty regular basis is weapons in the home. Many of our patients have weapons for security or for recreational use, and so it's important for our staff to know what those weapons are. And we have a discussion about how those weapons are secured, where they're located at, to make sure that our staff and our volunteers feel safe when they're going into the home. Another area are pets in the home, which are other family members to our patients. We run into situations where pets can be very protective of their owners, and so we have those conversations about, you know, perhaps it's best not only for the pet but for the patient to have the pet put into a different room when one of our clinicians shows up in the home. Most of the times, these pets love to see our clinicians, but there's a few times that we've had some issues. Some of the other areas that we deal with environmentally, because we are going into patients' homes, is there are some populations that we have run into where there are illegal drugs in the home. And so it's important for us to be non-judgmental. We're taking care of patients in their home setting. We want to meet them where they're at, but making sure that we have very clear boundaries of what can be out in the home when our staff are present and what we would prefer to not have to see when we come into the home. The other is unsafe living conditions. Not all of our patients live in conditions that we would choose ourselves. And so really, how do we come up with a plan of how to provide good, safe care for our patients that is very respectful, non-judgmental, and also protects the safety of our staff? Another area that we look at is the physical component. Many of our staff are going out to homes by themselves. They're working somewhat in isolation. They're traveling by themselves. And so how do we ensure that our staff have the tools that they need to protect themselves if they're either in a home by themselves and the situation becomes concerning, or if they're out driving? We have had a few isolated cases where our staff has been assaulted, and that's a variety of reasons. Sometimes people assume that because we are in healthcare that we have medications available on us, or just concerns about what someone might be able to get from one of our nurses. But also, this is a trying time for patients. They are in the end of life stage, and families don't always handle that as well as they could. Another area that we've had issues with are sexual advances from patients or family. most of these are ones that we don't think that there's really any real intent, but it does put our staff in a difficult situation when that's happening. Another area, the third area that that we see is psychosocial. You know, this is kind of a crisis period of time for patients and families. There's a lot of crisis intervention. Oftentimes, some of those old family situations crop up during this time. And many times, our staff are in a home and have to act as a mediator. The other is managing end-of-life expectations. No one goes into this really knowing what to expect, and so it's important that our staff communicate and educate the patients on what to expect at end-of-life, but also family members that can be skewed by their cultural beliefs, previous experiences with end-of-life, or just what they've heard out on the street about it. So it's very important that we manage that prior to end of life as much as possible, so we set those expectations. And then last but not least is conflicting goals of patient and family. It would be great if everyone was on the same page at end of life, but that doesn't always happen. And so oftentimes you'll have family members that have very different views of what treatment, what symptom management looks like, what end of life, even whether their loved one is truly at end of life. Oftentimes there's denial in what is actually happening. And so those are a lot of psychosocial issues that we need to deal with and make sure that we are addressing early on rather than being reactive to. And so one of the tools that we use, we have a electronic medical system that allows us to put alerts into the system, which makes that information available to anyone that is seeing the patient, no matter the setting or level of care, to kind of give them a heads up of what to expect when they go into the home, what conversations have already occurred, and what are the steps that have been put in place to make it a safe environment.
Can you please relay a few examples of situations that your team has experienced and how they dealt with these situations?
Sure. So a couple that come to mind, we had a patient who lived in a home by herself. She was, I believe, in her late 80s, early 90s, and it wasn't a great community. It was a neighborhood that had known illegal activity. She had a cell phone, but she often forgot to charge it, and so there wasn't a consistent form of communication. On top of that, she kept a loaded pistol near her at all times in case there was a break-in. We had conversations about whether there was a safer place to keep that firearm, and she felt that her safety was going to be compromised if we put it in a lockbox or asked her to keep it in a different room. She was also hard of hearing and had difficulty ambulating, so she had requested that we put a lockbox on the outside of the house so that our staff would have access to a key to get into the home. She also refused to leave her home at end of life. She wanted to die in her home. That was very important to her. So we got together, we problem solved, and one of the first things that we did was we provided her with a charger that she could keep at chairside so that she could keep her phone charged at all times. The plan was that our staff would call the patient when they arrived in front of the house to notify her that the staff were coming in. We also had an alert that indicated that anyone entering the room or the home to identify themselves as hospice employees loudly enough so that she could hear, and then to perform joint visits whenever possible. We wanted to have two people. You know, we talked about what would happen if she did not respond to us when we came into the home and felt like the joint visit was a good way to kind of alleviate any issues with that. Another patient that we had, he resided in a two-story apartment that had an unfinished access up to the second floor, and surprisingly enough, the patient and his spouse was using a six-foot ladder to access his apartment. The landlord was supposed to be fixing it, but had not gotten around to it. So when the patient came on service, we had tried to have conversation with the landlord, but could not get that person to call us back. So we would have the patient come outside to do visits, as this was really the only way to get to him. It wasn't feasible for our staff to climb up a ladder and bring all of their supplies up with them every time they came to see him. The other sad part about this was that we really were limited on the amount of durable medical equipment that we could provide just from a aspect of trying to get it up the ladder. So we were only able to get a bedside commode and a walker up when he really could have used a hospital bed. So the big picture was, you know, that the team just started talking about what would happen when he declined and could no longer use the ladder. We were able to send him to one of our inpatient units for some symptom management and was able to finally get an agreement with the landlord that the patient could reside in a different part of the apartment building, which was on ground level. It really was a front area of where the landlord lived. And this seemed like a good short-term solution, but really the patient and the significant other didn't feel comfortable living there, and they felt like they were isolated really to one room or bedroom in the house. There was also some concerns about drug use and others that lived in other parts of the home. So what we ended up doing is that we were only doing joint visits, and then our social worker worked to help get the patient a different apartment and get some Section 8 housing. So the patient and his spouse were finally able to move into their own apartment that was easily accessible. We were able to get the needed DME. Our staff were able to get in as they needed. And the patient actually spent the rest of his days with us quite happy that he had what he needed. Another patient that just happened not too recently, which kind of stands out in my mind, we had a patient that was on really high flow O2, residing at home with his spouse. No issues with where he lived. The problem was we received a call that there had been a suspected bomb in the patient's neighborhood. And the wife had called. There were police everywhere. No one was able to come in or out. They had established a perimeter. And so the patient's spouse calls our after-hours team to the report that the patient is extremely anxious, short of breath, and really needs to be removed from the home in the situation. There was also a concern because of the amount of O2 that he was utilizing during this stressful period that she wasn't going to have enough O2 on site. We sent a visit nurse out to try to visit the patient, and the police ended up turning her away, saying that no one was allowed in or out of the area. So what we did was we had our phone nurse stay on the phone with the spouse just to help talk her through, you know, offering support, options to help the patient to be less anxious and to conserve O2, while a second nurse called the local police department to kind of explain the situation and to help identify a plan to evacuate the patient's spouse safely through the help of our staff and then a local transport company. It took us several hours of conversation, but we were finally able to get the patient and the spouse evacuated and then transported to one of our inpatient units where we could treat the symptoms, we could get the patient comfortable, the spouse felt much more comfortable, and then after the event was mitigated, then we were able to transport the patient and the spouse back to their home.
Thank you for those very informative and eye-opening examples, Joyce. Those are great examples of your team's challenges and successes that they've had. A final question. What can home caregivers teach other healthcare providers, regardless of where they deliver care, that we should know about and consider when speaking of workforce, workplace safety, or threats of violence?
So I think the most important thing is just asking direct questions. You know, we don't assume anything. When we go into someone's home, we ask about weapons. We ask about how patients and families handle stress. We ask the tough questions, and oftentimes the answer to our question is, well, no, we don't have those things. We don't have those issues. But I think even for the inpatient side, asking the questions about what's going on at home, Because if we don't ask, we don't know what we're going to be dealing with. And we don't ask from a perspective of trying to change the living situation or be judgmental. It really is so that we are better prepared when we go into the home setting. A couple other things that come to mind, you know, really being aware of your surroundings in which you're providing care. You know, there's some simple tricks that we teach our nurses when they and CNAs when they go into a home. You know, make sure that you have your car keys on you at all times. Don't have them in a purse that's sitting somewhere. Make sure that you're always between the patient and family and an exit route. 99% of the time, you're not going to have to worry about that. But during those times when you do, it's very helpful to have an escape route already identified. Really trusting your instincts. You know, we tell our nurses, if you get into a situation and you don't feel comfortable, there's probably something going on that is making you feel that way. So, again, being very supportive and non-judgmental, but if something inside of you is saying that this isn't a safe situation, you know, just say, you know what, I've got to run out to my car real quick and make a phone call. Give someone a call, see if we can get another person to, you know, run over, help you do the visit. We don't ever want our staff to just stay in a situation because it's probably nothing. Again, meeting patients where they're at, non-judgmental. Many of the times when we see things escalate is when patients or families feel that someone's coming into their home and telling them how they should do things. Many of our patients and families live in situations that we ourselves would not choose to do, but even more important that we find a way to support them in that area. Again, having safety conversations early and often, you know, asking patients, okay, well, if you're by yourself, if something were to happen, what is your plan? How can we help facilitate that? And then really communicating with the rest of your team or placing alerts. We want to make sure that everyone that walks into the home has a good, clear picture of what they're going to encounter and not have surprises. Of course, we can't identify everything, and so we just want to limit the amount of surprises that our staff are walking into.
Joyce, thank you very much for sharing your insights and these examples and some of these best practices of things for any caregiver, regardless of the setting where they practice, to keep in mind. As healthcare delivery models expand to include the entire continuum of care, it is critical that we keep in mind that workplace violence can and does affect the workforce, whether they work in a hospital or outside of the hospital setting. The best practices that you shared, Joyce, are important for all leaders and staff to remember when considering how to discuss and educate our workforce about potential violence in the workplace and in communities. For other podcasts in our ongoing series, as well as a wealth of other resources around community and workplace violence, please visit the AHA's Hospitals Against Violence webpage, www.aha.org/HAV for Hospitals Against Violence. This concludes today's discussion. Thank you all for listening.